I'm Wendy. I'm from a 94-unit strata building. It is apartment style, and 1974, we have a very old pool area. Our project was repainting the whole area. Jim?
A 96-unit strata, self-managed at the moment. Vintage 1961, so mid-century. Reinforced steel concrete and 12 stories.
Hi, I'm Tony Davis, and I live in an 11-unit wood frame building on Dallas Road, which has the benefit of having a beautiful view of the strait, but has the downside of water intrusion. We get a lot of water coming in when we have those storms that people love to come out and watch.
David Grubb, we have two buildings and a heritage house, total of 50 suites. The two apartment buildings are three stories sitting over a parkade, and it's a wood frame building.
Okay, so back to Jim. What prompted your project? In my building, it was the depreciation report that pointed out the problems in the pool area.
Our building, back in 2007, we had long before people were talking about depreciation reports, we had an assessment done of our building. And back in 2007, it was noted that there was some delamination on our balconies, the concrete. It's reinforced concrete slabs for the floors, and it's basically just an extension of those slabs for the balconies. And delamination or spalling was found on those. And so it was first raised in 2007. And then we had in 2010, 2 years before our first depreciation report, we had another assessment done by an engineering consulting firm. And it was then that we started to take this very seriously, that we started to look at budgeting for it in terms of raising fees, monthly fees, in order to fund a contingency fund. And then in 2012, we had our first depreciation report, which called it out again. So we were already being proactive, or seemed to be being proactive in talking about it. And so it was really that the reports which took
got it all started.
Yep.
Does everybody know what delamination is? Can you, Jim, can you tell them what delamination is in the... Or spalling, I should say, spalling.
I'm not an engineer, but basically delamination would be shavings of concrete, I think, coming up off the surface and sometimes revealing the reinforcing bars, which then leads to oxidization and rust, so compromising the integrity of that reinforced concrete slab. So serious stuff, but something that you can either see if it's bad enough, or you can do what's called a tap test, I think, which would then reveal that separation of the concrete just by listening and feeling it.
So we're talking about what prompted your project then.
Okay, yeah, what prompted our project? It started off really quite innocently. We thought we were just, we were going to replace the vinyl on some of our decks. The vinyl had been replaced on a number of decks by a so-called handyman, and we decided we wanted to finish the rest of the decks off, and we would get a professional decking company to come in and do it for us. When they came in, they took a look at the decks and said, "Well, who did this?" And then they said that the way the vinyl had been put down, it was stopping the water from draining off of the deck. They blocked the drainage holes up. And also that the way the decks were constructed, and this goes back to, 1972, the vinyl could not be replaced without removing some of the, we had pony walls then, some of the pony wall material. So we decided we better take a closer look at these decks that were, first of all, that were apparently blocked up. And underneath the deck was a metal grill, and when we pulled it out, we found that there was all kinds of bird feathers and leaves and things in there. And the same was true with the other decks that had not been, had their vinyl replaced. So the immediate question came to mind, well, if the water's not draining off of the deck surface, where is it going? And of course it's going inside the balcony is where it's going. And then we were off to the races. We had to, get a contractor to actually take the decks apart. And then we had to have an engineer to supervise the taking of the decks apart. How far do you want me to go, Wendy?
Well, we'll get into maybe more of the process in a minute, but let's...
Yeah, okay, but what started out as a very, you know, we'll just replace the vinyl, and suddenly we're into a major project.
We've been doing major projects since 2004, but I'll just stick to one that is sort of still underway. As a result of the depreciation report in 2013, the buildings, the two apartment buildings, are sitting on a cement slab over the parkade, and the cement slab, identified by the engineers, was never sloped properly away from the wall. So we had, we started to have rot, apparently, underneath, creeping into the building envelope. And as a result, we thought, well, okay, let's have a better look. And sure enough, we cut open the base of the wall and found, fortunately, we dodged the bullet to a degree because there wasn't all that much rot. But obviously, you can't have base plates and studs rotten inside. But that left us with a real problem because the engineers came back and said, well, there's no point in just fixing up the studs and the woodwork. You re-slope the deck away from the wall so it won't happen again. So what started out as just putting some new studs in developed into a $175,000 job to re-slope the walls because we had to take the balcony rails off. That involved bringing them up to code, and I'll talk about that later. Something that seems simple isn't so simple. And fortunately, we had money in the bank, but we'll get to that.
And maybe just a quick question of the audience. How many people are in Stratus who have finished a project of, I don't know, let's say 50,000 or more in the last couple of years? Two, three, 5 years? 11 million, my goodness. How many people have something coming up in their Stratus in, say, the next 3 years that's quite large? Wow. Okay. So we're all in the same boat. So we touched on this a little bit, but this is such an important part. What process was used to plan your project and get bids? Very short one for our painting project. Council at first thought that we could write an RFP and get bids. That did not go so well. We ended up getting a consultant in the end. But I'm just keeping my samples very short because these guys have much more interesting stories.
I hope. We're 96 units. We have a volunteer council, obviously, and we use a committee approach. So what we wanted to do first for our balcony project was strike a committee to help council. That committee consisted of a couple of council members, so that there were, the lines of communication were very important, that we maintain them. So with the committee together, we started, we knew that because it was a large project, about $750,000, that we would require the assistance of consultants, and those would be consulting engineers in our case. So what we started was the process of vetting three engineering firms to help us. And we did a comparison matrix, basically, because we were accompanying this process with information sessions for the owners. So basically, we were keeping the ownership up to date on how the process was going. So we created a matrix, a comparison matrix, interviewed the three companies, checked with their references, and then got proposals from those three companies. So then we had the first initial numbers to work with. So we knew from the beginning that we were going to go with the so-called design bid build approach. So you engage a consulting engineer who will not only create a specification for you, but will also manage the acquisition of the necessary permits and basically guide you through the process, maybe a little bit like project management. They will also create the bid package, which at least in our case, at least five contractors responded to, and then the engineers helped us with the final selection of which contractor we were gonna go with on the project. So that was our approach.
And maybe we need to always remind people what project, because here we're talking about concrete balconies. Okay, Tony.
So yeah, I'm still talking about balconies and what was supposed to be just vinyl replacement. Once we had found that we had some water getting into the balconies or not getting out of the balconies, then we knew that we were probably into some deconstruction and reconstruction. So we put out some tenders for a construction company, and we subsequently hired them. And with the idea that we were just going to repair the balconies, and that would be the end of it. But we subsequently used them to manage the project. When we thought we could just get up on the balconies and people would these guys would take them apart. Apparently, you can't do that. You have to have an engineer with you to watch what you're doing. So we had to have an engineer with us, and we were in kind of a funny state because we really didn't know what we were going to find, and so we really didn't know how much money, so we really couldn't tell the owners what it's going to cost. All we could tell them was that we've probably got water damage. And we did have, once we started to open up the balconies under the supervision of the engineer, then we did see mold and water damage. And then everybody threw their hands up, and we got an estimate on what it was going to cost us, and we'll get into that, I guess, a little later. But moving forward from there, we had to deal with the city as well, because we were making major changes to the building. And that was another fun thing to do, deal with the city. Because we were working on the envelope, then we had to get an engineering firm in that were familiar with envelopes. And so the project was essentially managed just by council. We're only an 11-unit building, and it was very hard to strike a committee. You look around and we were the committee. But we did have the contractor sort of managing the project for us. If this sounds like a let's see what happens next project, that's what it was.
And you see in your handouts that towards the end we're going to talk about what did we learn.
So, I learned.
David, one thing, would you describe your project as a combination of foundation and patio balcony? Because I'm not quite sure.
Well, it is the foundation because the patios are, in fact, the cement foundation over the parkade. It's a 6-inch slab. They are, aside from the common areas, they become the balconies or the patios of four suites. But obviously we had to do something to protect the building, building envelope, and so the four owners benefit from having all this work done. We learned long, long time ago that we don't have the expertise amongst our owners. we made some mistakes a long time ago. We hired a project manager who knows something, who knows a lot about the trades and about engineering, et cetera, et cetera. The manager put out tenders for engineering because obviously we were going to need engineers to design certainly the base of wall problems, take care of that. But because we had to pull the balcony rails off, we went through some gyrations because what we had to decide, they were cedar siding balconies. They did not meet code. So do we put cedar siding back, which is very expensive, or do we go for aluminum railing, which is very popular? We had some town hall meetings and put up some designs to see what people seem to like. And we can get into the nitty-gritty, but the ultimate upshot was we were going to replace as much as possible to keep it in conformity with the rest. If we'd started putting railings up, we would have had to consider all the balconies on the second and third floor, which were all cedar siding. And would it look any good? Well, we've got, that's phase three down the line. We're going to have to deal with the balconies. And so we had to think ahead in order to say, what do we want the building to look like? If we're going to replace a lot of the balconies, do we put in aluminum rail? And the decision was, this is too much. So we agreed primarily to put in, replace it. It's hardy plank, which looks pretty close to cedar, and it will be a lot better. But having decided on that, then the engineer, we put out for engineers' bids, as has been mentioned. We accepted one engineer. The engineer designed the scope and the specifications for the project, and our project manager managed the engineer too, because engineers love to spend money on Cadillac programs. And so we said, no, there are some things we don't want to do. It's not necessary. But the engineer did specify all the things that had to happen with the walls, and we had to go to some rain screen technology. Fortunately, because there was so little rot, it didn't go up beyond 12 inches. If it had gone much further than that, we would have had to rip out all the stucco from the base of the wall all the way up to the first floor. And that would have been rain screen technology. So,
And we'll talk a little bit more about scope.
We'll do that. But they designed the scope, and we developed the specifications, and as normal, we send out our project manager identified companies. We send out a request for quotation, not a request for proposal. The proposal was already there because we knew exactly what we wanted to do, because the engineer had said, here's what we wanted to do in resloping and fixing the wall and all that. So we sent out a request for quotation with all the precise specifications. That is so essential, we've found, because if you send out a request for quotation, you could get five different quotations based on five different things, or proposals. A proposal can come back, and five different proposals with five different ideas. We had the ideas in place, so we just said, here are the specs, what's it going to cost?
Great. Some of you might know that Sandy and I live in the same building, so she asked me to elaborate on ours. And I think I'm going to segue into the next question about timeline, but let's just, did you have something to add from your own experience or a question? We've got a mic. Jack's going to bring the mic over. Thanks. It was just a quick clarification question on the point you made. So when you had a basic decision as to whether you were going to, say, replace the railings with hardy plank or
go with aluminum. How did you make that decision? Was it a majority vote, or what was the process?
Yeah, we didn't have a vote particularly. Well, we didn't because it deals with how much you want to spend. We had drawings put up in the lobbies. We canvassed people with it. We had a town hall meeting to kick ideas around about whether this or that or would look like. The basic result was they wanted to keep the look of the building with hardy plank for the most part, but they were prepared to, if it would work out, they were prepared to have some parts of it with aluminum railing. And I'll get to that later. We did run into a situation where we could do some changes. But if we'd gone for all the railing, it would have been far cheaper. But if that didn't look good and we changed our mind at the last minute, then we couldn't alter. We'd have to go back to the owners for more money. So we chose the higher amount based on the hardy plank, and we could always spend less, but not more. But it was a consultation amongst the owners in taking it to the general meeting to ask for the money. We had the specification there.
So the next question is about timeline, which kind of fits in with the whole process that you've just heard for each person. And I'll just say very quickly, the painting project for our pool area, we have a hot tub, a pool, a exercise room. This is not a $1 million project. We've spent 2 years getting to this place. We started off thinking that council could get a quote. So we got a quote. We set a budget. We had an AGM. We had the budget approved. We thought that we could write our own request for proposals. We sent it out. We found that every single painter wanted to use a different kind of paint. And some of those paints were literally 60% more expensive than the others. We had no idea what to do. We spoke to a paint specialist, and he introduced us to what they call the MPI, Master Painters Institute, classifications of paint, which is a very specific way of saying, okay, if you're going to have an RFP, this is the type of paint we want. You have to make sure the manufacturer, there's different manufacturers who make that paint, but here's the specification. So we thought, oh, okay, good. We'll send out our RFP again saying this paint. So we got our prices back, and a couple of the painters said, no, we don't agree with that. We're not comfortable re-quoting. So that whole process fell apart. And finally, one of the painters said, you need to talk to a consultant. And it was the best advice we ever got. We have now a third-party paint specialist consultant. He wrote up the specifications. We did exactly what these fellows said. We sent it out again to tender. We got our prices. We chose a contractor. And now that third-party person is supervising and checking the process, the prepping, the painting, everything along the way. So he's basically like a mini project manager, but he gets paid by the painter. And the painter looks real scared every time he pops in to check on them, because they know that he's making them do all the work according to the Master Painters Institute. But that's why it's taken us 2 years for this little thing, and they've just started, and we hope it's going to be finally done in 2 weeks. Timeline. Jim, you've got a long one too.
We started organizing ourselves in May of 2013, and the project finished in February of 2015. There was, just like these guys have mentioned, there was a big, big explosion in the project, which increased the scope, which I'll talk about maybe at a later time.
So it took you less than 2 years to do a project of 96 balconies, and it took us much longer just to do a little painting job. You're much more efficient.
Well, if you think that's efficient, it took us just over a year to restore our balconies. We had a good project manager who dealt with the city, and believe me, the city was the biggest holdup for us. Just impossible to deal with to get things, get them to approve things, to get to even talk to them, they would hide. The guy, when we first started, I just to tell you this, when we first started to take the balconies apart, but this guy turned up in a car, pulled up alongside the building and said, "You're going to have to stop." He called, wanted somebody down to talk to. I said, "Who the hell are you?" He says, "I'm from the city." I said, "Where's your card? Where's your, you know, who are you?" He says, "Oh, I don't have a business card, but I'm with the city. And you've got to stop until we give you a permit to start work." And that was, you know, the start of our dealings with the city. They were the worst people. This is Victoria, of course, probably quite different here. They were the worst people to deal with. But once we had somebody to deal with the city, then things worked a lot better. Maybe because the guy was kind of big and could go and lean on them. That seemed to work. The other bit of a delay that we had was we just thought we could have an engineer and a construction company. But, of course, we had to get this environmental engineering company as well because we were dealing with the envelope. But they were good. They supervised the work on that the construction people were doing. It sounds very complicated, but it actually worked quite well. I think that's it.
We as I said, we first knew of this problem with the depreciation report. We had the engineer come in. I did a quick one when Wendy nailed me on this. October 1st, 2014, we had a town hall meeting with an engineer to learn about the problems. January, we hired a project manager to assist us. We worked on ideas through till March, and then we had we had to get some hazmat services in simply because if you're going to break a wall open, especially for buildings of our age, chances are you're going to have asbestos in the walls. That adds considerably to your costs. At the end of March, we authorized expenditures to get further information on the damage. By April, we had signed a contract with an engineer to do the specifications, drawings, and an opinion of probable cost. That's a sort of outside budget figure. Because, as I mentioned, we had the two options of do we go with the hardy plank or do we go with railing, by May, early May, the engineer came up with what they call an OPC, an opinion of probable cost for the two options. The next day, we put out a notice. End of May, we had a general meeting, and they voted for option one, which was the more expensive one. From there, by the time May through June, we put together everything, and because we still had to put all the engineers' final documents, specifications, et cetera, et cetera. Early July, we put out the general contract conditions, the engineers' final documents, specifications, and drawings, and we issued them to the contractors. They have to have time to think about it, so look at it. We called the contractors on-site meeting. They all met together with our project manager, did a walkabout. August 5th, the bid documents were received and opened. August the 6th, we signed with one contractor. August 11th, the construction started, and we finished the project on November the 30th. That was substantial completion. It would have been completed earlier, except we ran into a couple of hiccups, and I'll come to that sometime later. But what you should observe is all of the planning, if we take it, even if we'd had the talk about it in October, all of the planning planning was from January to August. And I think you should make sure that you understand if you're going to do a good job, it takes time to plan and get everything in place so that you don't have any surprises as far as cost. You don't have very many surprises as far as the project itself.
Trying to do math in my head, is that like two-thirds of the time for planning and one-third of the time for construction? Something like that, yeah. We have a hand up at the back. Maybe, Jack, do you want to give John the microphone to run around with?
I have a question. When the engineer gives you a report of their cost, how do they determine, is that their actual cost, or can you get other contractors or whatever involved in a project which would be less than the engineer's actual cost that he's decided or they think that it should be? Does it make sense what I'm asking?
No, that's it.
Because there's often a big conflict between an engineer wants.
That's correct.
What you actually pay.
That is correct. That is why it is an opinion of probable cost. And generally speaking, it is very high. But it's worthwhile not to ignore it and put that money aside. Generally speaking, the bids that come in later will be far less. But remember, it's simply a budget. Budgets are simply, this is what we think it may cost. When you have those budgets, they may be high, but like every good government, you think high, and when it comes in low, aren't you nice guys? The opinion of probable cost, and you've got to factor in that depending on the project, the contractor may have a specific idea in mind, but there are all sorts of other things. You need to build in a contingency because something can go wrong. You need to build in other issues that might come in, like extra hazmat reports or something else you want to do. All of those are built. That you get those built into the probable costs, so you get a total figure. I think our probable costs were somewhere in the nature of $190,000 for our project for opinion one. Once we'd taken the engineer's opinion and added our project manager's extras, it was about $190,000. By the time we'd got the bids, once we said, okay, we'll spend $190,000, and you need to have the money in the bank first. Then you put in the specifications. And that's what we said. Okay, we're going for project A. Tell us about what you have to do with the building envelope. Tell us what you have to do. How much is it, do you think it's going to cost to, what is the design of the balcony rail? Because it's going to be a lot stronger, a lot different from what we've got. What is it going to cost to have a company come in and re-slope the floor? We not only had re-sloping the floor, we cored some of the cement so that the drainage would drain in the middle instead of going to the wall, which it was. And because we had a core, we had to redo some plumbing underneath in the parquet.
And we are going to get into hiccups and changes in scope.
That was all put in the plan, okay? That was the probable cost we said. Once we had all the specifications, the engineer said, you will use this kind of railing, you will use this kind of aluminum, you will do this kind of rain screen technology, you will use this kind of resurfacing material. All of that went in. And so when you put it out, it's a specification. Now that's what the contractors are going to bid on. You already have the $190,000 there. As it turns out, the contractor came in and the bid we took Their particular part of it was $102,000. The extras that we wanted were farmed out to other companies, which our project manager took care of. All total, we came in at about $145,000. Okay? What you're doing to start with to get your money in the bank is, and going after your people, is the probable cost. Probable, not, you know, that's an outside cost. But yeah, it is not, you can't shop around.
David?
Okay.
We're going to leave actually most of the financial budgeting, planning, that type of thing to the second half. So, sorry to...
Just one thing, you can't shop around. Okay, at this stage, at the planning stage, you can't shop around. Only when you have your definitive plan from your engineer, when you get those very clear specifications, then you shop it out to five contractors.
Right. So we're clear that there is such a thing as an opinion of probable cost, and then there's actually the tendering process that's going to get you your actual construction bids. I'm sorry, someone else had a question. Did you want to wait for the mic to come around? I heard the voice. I didn't see where it came from. Somewhere in here. No? No question? Okay. The next question is actually a really quick one because we've touched on it, is who managed the project? In our case, like I said, council tried. It failed. We got a consultant for our painting. Jim?
Engineering consultants. So one firm.
And they managed the project as well? Okay.
Our contractor managed the project for us.
I've already said we had a project manager.
A third party, yeah. Anybody in the audience, did their council try to manage a project? Anyone? Just one strata?
No? What's the difference between a project manager and an engineering firm?
Did everyone hear that? What's the difference between a project manager and an engineering firm?
An engineering firm can run a project. A construction company, as Tony said, can run the project. We had a third-party project manager who knows the building industry, knows how to deal with engineers, and keep us out of trouble. Entirely, you know, engineers, and I've had this question come at me before, well, how can we trust the engineer? Because they want the Cadillac job, and we don't know. Okay? Now, I trust engineers. You know, they're going to give you good service. But the fact is that using our project manager, we backed the engineer off on some of the, there's no question about the specifications, but we backed them off on some things that weren't really necessary that they thought should be there. So our project manager was our owner's representative that worked with the engineer and then subsequently with the contractor. The engineer also was involved necessarily, because they would come in and inspect to make sure that the contractor did, in fact, do what the specification said. They had to write that off. So it was there are three people involved. But our project, our owner's representative, made sure that these guys were in line.
I am curious from the audience just to know, because there were a lot of hands up for your large projects, how many people had, first of all, council try to manage the project? Anybody? Few? A quick thumbs up or thumbs down, how did that go?
Thumbs up.
All thumbs up, excellent. How many people had an engineer manage the project itself? How about a construction company manage their own project? No? Did anyone here have their property manager manage the project? Do you have a hand up? Okay. You can see there's a lot of ways you can go. Advantages, disadvantages for them all. I think there was a question. Did you want... Just wait for the mic, but put your hand up so that John knows where you are.
With a property manager, but with a very strong overview of council and watching every step of the way. And we, as well, had engineer reports done much earlier than what the government required back in the you know, 2007 and that area. So we had been planning to do all these things, but we have a strata management firm.
And did they come on site to actually?
Oh, absolutely.
They did, okay.
Yeah.
Because that's something we sometimes get asked is when a property management company manages your project, what do they actually do, since they're not construction people themselves?
No, but they have, if they're good property managers, they know who's in the area, who might be good, and then they bring it to council, and council can choose, and if they need to, it goes to an AGM.
That's to choose your construction company, you mean?
To choose the costs and the options of what the costs would be.
But who managed the project when the project was underway?
The property manager.
They did. Okay. Mm-hmm. Okay, good. What's next on our list? During construction, how did the project progress get communicated to council and owners? We had a really interesting discussion on our Facebook page one day with a strata owner who was having a terrible time. She said the project had, for their building envelope, had dragged on well past a year. Council wasn't telling owners anything about what was going on. She'd asked for documents, and there was just nothing. So the owners are feeling very, very frustrated that they weren't being kept up to date on why the project was running long. So maybe we have some ideas here of how you manage that.
Very straightforward there, briefly, bi-weekly meetings, this is during the construction phase, which were attended by the consulting engineers, by members of the council, and by the contractors. This would follow an inspection, regular inspections of the construction by the consulting engineers to hold the hands of the contractors to the fire, make sure that everything's being built according to the specification. And with respect to the balcony project, excellent. I mean, we were really grateful for the agenda being sent to us prior to the meeting. The meetings were accurately minuted by the consulting engineers, and the communication flow was good. On a monthly basis, at the very least, the balcony committee submitted a update to the council for inclusion in the minutes. So at the very least, owners were informed once a month of the construction phase, and more frequently if they just approached a member of the committee or the council.
So we had informal strata meetings whenever there was something to communicate, or sometimes we would have the contractor along to give progress reports. We would have more formal strata meetings when there was financial matters being discussed or there was a vote to be taken. We also put a newsletter, but it wasn't a regular newsletter. We would send around some kind of a flyer to everybody on their door. You couldn't use email. Hardly anybody had email. And this we would send around if there was going to be something happening that was going to affect them. Now, that, for instance, if we needed to block off the parking lot, or if there was going to be scaffolding erected the next day, then we would send a notice around so they would know what was going on.
Our project manager actually did a lot of hard work every week. He would issue a progress report, and we'd pin it on the notice boards, so everyone in general knew what was going on. He was in constant liaison with me for most of the time, and I would also meet with him and contractor's supervisor on site, and the engineer when he came to inspect. So we kept in constant communication, and we made sure that any questions or concerns were expressed either to me or to the project manager directly. He left his phone number and said, call me, so that people had every way of expressing concerns or getting information.
And for the people in the audience, did anyone have a project where you were frustrated, that you weren't getting up-to-date information from a contractor or an engineer or anything like that? Everybody had good communications with their people on their project? Wow, it sounds like we had some smooth projects. It's good. I'm going to combine... Oh, I'm sorry. John's going to come around with it. I know it sounds like we're loud when we're in the audience, but usually the people behind can't hear, so...
I had one question of David Grubb. You mentioned that... Did you say that residents could contact the project manager themselves directly? And not through you, but directly?
They could go to the project manager, our project manager. He invited them to ask questions. If they had concerns, they could go to him as well. So he was, but they, we specifically said, don't talk to the workers and complain. Don't talk to the construction manager and complain. That's not, you know, it's nothing to do with them. Don't talk to the engineer. That's not their business. Their business is to run the project on behalf of us, so that just between our project manager and myself, we could generally resolve problems, so that if someone did have a concern, and I would put notices out too if there was an issue, or we had to make up parking signs, or as Tony said, you know, if something was going to happen, I would put the stuff off or publish something and let people know. So the owners have every right to know what's going on, but this way it's controlled so that you don't have people whining and complaining at the guys who don't need that kind of a hassle.
Thank you.
So my next question was going to be, did this project stay within scope? Were there any surprises? I think that kind of fits in with what went right, what went wrong. Does that kind of work together? If it does, I'll leave it however you want to answer.
So within scope, the actual balconies that we were doing, that was more or less in scope. The surprises were the spalling, the degradation of the slab was worse than we thought. What the engineers managed was a sampling. We got 96 balconies, so we did about 10. Looked at them and extrapolated. And that's what engineers are going to do often. And there was some opposition in the building. Some people wanted it all done, just the inspection of every balcony. It would have been prohibitively expensive if the engineers were doing that at their rates. So we didn't, but it turns out that the damage or the degradation of the slab was worse than we thought. So we needed more concrete, we needed more formwork than expected. So the price did go up. Luckily, what we had budgeted with the help of the engineers was more or less accurate. So there was enough wiggle room in there that we didn't spend a lot more money. However, our little mini explosion in the project was that as the balconies were being worked on, the crews of contractors noticed spalling on the what we call eyebrows. So each floor of our building has a little extension of the concrete slab, which provides shade for the building. And they noticed that on that portion of the slab, there was spalling. So that was basically an $80,000, 2.5 month extension to the job. And so that was our surprise. So officially, you could say that the project stayed in scope. There are often knock-on effects and discoveries that people make of other things. And if you've got a contractor on your building that's set up their work site, they've set up their swing stage, their auxiliary power and everything, they're going to say, hey, we could do it. So you're sort of between a rock and a hard place because, as far as I know, a contractor is not going to let a third party or another contractor use their setup. So we were in a bit of a bind. We had to go back to the ownership because it was more money. We had to have a special general meeting and ask for approval of those funds. And the project... we did the right thing. We addressed it. However, that was a real big surprise. So.
And I have, because you've told me this story before, can you tell them about the eyebrows having already been repaired?
The eyebrows had been repaired earlier, several years. I'm afraid I'm not sure exactly. It was before my time, so it was over 8-9 years ago that they were done. So there was talk of maybe the job not being done properly at that time, but you know, we couldn't really address that. We had to address the problem as it was diagnosed. So what it led to were hammer testing of the eyebrows and significant work on the eyebrows as well. So that was a big
And you did deal. You did mention to me that the engineers had shown you that the method that had been used a few years back was not the correct method, and so the water was getting in again.
Yeah, right? It may be a little bit technical, but when you're when you're dealing with spalling and you're cutting out concrete, you should cut out vertically and actually create a trough, whereas some of the work we'd seen that had been done, they'd actually moved the concrete like this, and basically, if it's like this, then there's not a hard edge, and so it's probably more prone to delamination in the future than if you actually go down and do a proper, that's my interpretation of it at least. And so the work wasn't done that well, but I'm not sure what the statute of limitations or whatever would be in that, but we didn't pursue anything there.
But what I took away from the story was, the contrast was that the job done years before had been done just straight to a contractor without any design specifications being done of the method that should have been used. And sure enough, a few years go by, and it's noticed that they really needed to be done properly.
And it was during the balcony project, it was very reassuring to every 2 weeks see the engineers on the swing stages going up and down inspecting, because obviously that's your insurance. So that was very helpful.
Well, as I said earlier, the we had some really, really big surprises, because what it started out as a simple vinyl deck replacement project and then developed into let's renovate and replace all of the decks. We ran into rot, which of course was a safety issue as well. We had something we had to deal with. We also in the balconies. We ran into some rot on our. We have a sort of breezeway type parking area at the back, and we ran into rot there, which was looking like part of the building might fall down if we left that. And then we also, on the other side of the building, we found the contractors found dry rot under my suite, and that had to be dealt with. And the dry rot there was, interestingly, was once again, I think, a handyman special. Somebody had got in there sometime and said, oh, we can fix this really easy. We had some challenges along the way. I think we were lucky, really, that we did discover this the rot and the mold and the dry rot when we did, because I think we were lucky. We dodged a bullet, actually.
We didn't have that many surprises. The engineer did a splendid job of having a good look at what had to be done in the first place, so that we didn't. And the designs were absolutely fantastic, and in fact they incorporated some new technology just to see whether it would work. It's working very well. The only hiccups we had were, we found once we lifted the cant strip against the base of the wall, there was some kind of strip underneath it that had asbestos in it. I have no idea why it was there. I don't know what was going on. But the contractor had to down tools and say, sorry, this is a hazmat thing. And so we had some issues in deciding how to get this stuff out of the concrete. And it started, they said, oh, well, you've got to chip this out by hand, because you can't have, as they say, a friable asbestos floating around in the air. So our project manager and the engineer and the people concerned said, well, there's got to be a way around that. And they eventually came to an agreement that if they enclosed it with a plastic thing, a movable plastic thing, they could use electric tools to burr it out, and that worked. The only other problem we had was self-inflicted. There were privacy walls from the fire door out, for each of the units, and they were brick, cement brick, and that was actually part of what caused our problem in the first place. But we said, well, we got to replace them, and so we didn't decide what to do about what would be put back in. So it took us a bit of a while to figure out, and we had to get what kind of screens and what the design would look like. And as it turned out, we got some very nice new screens, and they were aluminum screens that the owners were satisfied with. As far as within scope, everything else went quite right. And in fact, we saved some money because there was a stairway at the back of the building and the south end of the building. And we were going to put in the RE plank, but because of the cement wall that it was supposed to be on, that the original theater was, the wall was too thin, and it meant that they were going to have to put in another 6-inch concrete wall running down the stairs. So we went back to the owners and said, well, instead of doing this, here's what an aluminum rail would look like. And we already had, at the front of the building, we already had iron, the old iron, fancy.
Wrought iron?
Wrought iron thing. And said, you know, make this black and it will look pretty much like the wrought iron. Look good. So we saved money by not having to put in another concrete wall plus all the hardy plank. But other than that, no, we were on scope, we're on target, and it worked out well.
We had a question. I'm sorry, I should have gotten to you sooner.
That's okay. I promise this is my last question. When you have engineers and project managers involved, who warranties the work that's being done? Is the onus back onto the engineer,
or
the project manager, or both?
Warranty was the next thing that we were going to talk about.
But the engineer has to warrant that's what he designed, that's what was put in.
So my next question was going to be, did this work or the components, or is there anything about your project that comes with a warranty, and if so, are there conditions?
We had not only the slabs redone, but originally our building from the 60s had brick balustrades, brick railings. Those were, of course, by 1960 standards, they were about 6 inches below code, so relatively low. And because we had to remediate the slab, you have to free up the slab, which means removing the brick, which put us into the category of new railings. So in answer to your question, we had to... The membrane that was placed on top of the new slab, protective membrane, that's warrantied. All the components of the glass and aluminum railings that we went to are warrantied. So I like to call it sort of an owner's manual. The obligation is on our strata to inspect those balconies on a yearly basis. We're going through basically and looking for any scratches on the membranes. And part of this owner's manual would be not putting down furniture that has sharp metal edges that might be dragged across and might cause problems with the membrane. Also look at scratches in the glass, any joints that are, you know, wobbly, any screws that are loose, that sort of thing. So common sense things that then provide proof that you've actually looked at problems and been proactive if you've seen anything necessary. But certainly there's a warranty that comes with all those components of our new balconies.
So if you didn't do those inspections, then you might negate your warranty?
Yeah, if we didn't do the inspections, we'd have no record of the inspections. So again, 96 balconies, you know, it's a fair-sized annual report that requires some time. Just gaining access to units, you know, it's such a hassle because people don't want you coming in their units sometimes, or they're absentee owners. So you've got to go through the process of actually gaining access. So it's a bit of an administrative nightmare. The actual inspections can be done really quickly. They're visual inspections, so lay people can do them too if they know what they're looking for.
And do any of the inspections have to be done by the engineer who gave the warranty? The warranty?
Not that I'm aware of.
Yeah, okay, just curious.
But it is a document that the people doing the inspection should be aware of. It's not exciting reading, but it's necessary.
I'll get back to the city again. I got a real bee in my bonnet about those folks. We had an environmental engineer who essentially signed off on the whole project. And on the basis of them signing off on the project, then the city gave us something called an occupancy completion permit. I'd like to read you a couple of sentences from it. This permit is not a representation or warranty that the bylaws of the City of Victoria or other enactments have been complied with, since resources at the city only permit random review and inspections. The City of Victoria will accept no responsibility or legal liability should any person suffer loss, injury, or damage as a result of the building not complying with bylaws. You know. So what exactly do these guys do, you know, for you in ensuring that you have done a good job? The building's safe again. They give you this occupancy permit, but it sort of then takes them off the hook on everything. I think we're essentially left with it's the environmental engineer that carries the can, because they only give you this permit once they get the sign off from the environmental engineer. But the language is kind of interesting.
Saanich does the same thing. Municipalities don't want to accept any liability for nothing know-how, and they always pass it to someone else. In our case, again, it was the engineer who signed off on the building permits, et cetera, to say, yes, the work was accomplished. But Saanich said, well, that's very nice. I'm glad you took the responsibility, because we won't. Saanich, I don't think, is as bad as Victoria, but they do get sticky, so go and talk to them. Warranties, yes, it was built into the request for quotation, the general specifications and the engineering specifications built in that the warranties must be there. So the resurfacing of the deck had to be warrantied. Metals for the and construction of the balcony rails, etc. All of that came with manufacturer's warranties, and of course the engineer is signing off, and the contractor was responsible as well, that they could be held responsible for the work they did. And naturally, that was inspected both by the engineer as well as our project manager to assure us that we got a good job done. Always build it into your request for quotation in your general specifications.
I'm going to tell you a sad story about our pool area. There's a certain, we knew going into this, as soon as we had our wonderful consultant and he wrote up the right kind of paint for the room, he said, but there's one area of a wall that's on an exterior wall where there's no waterproofing on the outside of that concrete block wall, where unless we waterproof it, we will never be able to keep the moisture out properly just on that height. So it is biting us, because right now we're in some wet weather, so they can't even paint that portion of the wall for this project. They have to wait till it dries out a bit. But it is just an example of the fact that, yes, there's an excellent warranty for the work and the paint and the consultant's warranty as well, except that it has specified that particular area has no warranty. So it's very interesting to build that in. Yeah. And we have a question over there, John? And then I'm going to call Sandy back up here in just a minute.
Two questions, actually. One, when we talk about warranty, I'm always a little bit shocked at how short those warranties are. So I'm wondering if you could speak to, like, when you say it was warrantied, how long a warranty are you talking about? For, like, some of these are significant structural components.
Our roof was 10 years.
Okay. I'm not sure exactly what the warranty was on the on the balconies. I do know that, just as you're saying, we're getting a big window project done right now, and it's astonishingly short. I think it's like 2 years. So on windows. So the balcony slabs, I'm not sure. I think it's at least five. I mean, that it's going on. It might be much more. I don't recall exactly, but those inspections we have to do.
Okay, I'm going to call Sandy up.
Sorry,
I'm so sorry.
Two other questions. When you talked about doing the inspections annually, when you said they or we, is that a member of council who goes around and does them and writes up this report? Is that what you're saying?
It is, yeah. And the guidelines for the report are pretty straightforward, but because we're self-managed at the moment, the onus is on us, so two people going around. Yeah.
Thank you.
Oh, we're good, yeah. So I think that's a good segue time to have our coffee break. Please reuse your...
So just in case I forget at the end, I'm sure all of you have at some point visited our website. It'll be in your pamphlets and whatnot in there, visoa.bc.ca. If you go to our resources page and look down, it lists a whole bunch of publications and resources. And look under government. Number 11 is a document that you might be interested in. It's put out by the Homeowners Protection Office, and it's called Guide to Managing Renewal Projects in Multi-Residential Buildings. So it was put together by the Homeowner Protection Office and engineers, and also BC Housing, the Ministry of BC Housing. So it's a great resource for us, and that's why we have it available on our site. So we kind of finished off the end of the first half, and these are the big final questions. What was the one thing you wish you had known before this project began? Anything, Jim? Well, for me, it was that there was such a thing as the MPI classification system for paints. Who knew? Jim?
I think with the big project, like the $750,000 balcony job, cost. So we saw a number in our depreciation report, and that number in the case of that particular project was within about 10-15%. So it was extremely accurate. But if you have to do an SGM to go and ask the ownership for new money, an SGM requires a lot of work, either on your own parts or that of the property manager. So I would say we should have asked for more money. We're now doing a larger window project, and that it's probably the biggest thing in our depreciation report, this project. And so the DR, the depreciation report, gave us a number. Then came the opinion of probable cost from our consultants, which was over twice that amount. So if the spirit of depreciation reports is to force or help stratas to financially plan, then I really have to question their accuracy. And I was speaking with an engineer, a mechanical engineer the other day, who's not related to our project or anything, and he said, Jim, what do you expect for $5,000? So that's roughly what we paid. So I would suggest to anyone who's got these big projects, if they're big ticket numbers, big ticket items, don't necessarily trust those numbers. So maybe pay a few extra $1,000 if it's a $1 million job or whatever, to have that particular project examined, either by a contractor who might end up doing the work, just to make sure you get a handle on those numbers.
Just another way of getting a broad number so that you could budget for
exactly.
It.
Exactly, yeah. And one tiny more thing I would say, be very conscious of the relationship between your project manager or consulting engineers and all the subs that will be involved in the project. Hazmat, it's a huge one for us because our building's from 1960, so asbestos and vermiculite. For many projects, there's design involved, so aesthetic design, so you might want to get an architect involved. Be very aware that the relationship between the consulting engineer or the project manager and the architect, because the consulting engineer should be looking out for your interests. In reality, of course, they're looking out for number one. So buyer beware there. But yeah, clarify all those relationships between the subs, because they can come as a surprise sometimes. And so, as other panelists have said, it's all in the planning beforehand. So,
just John will just take a second to come up to the front there.
I'm sorry, what do you mean by clarify the relationship? They get on together, like they'll talk to each other, or?
Firstly, who's paying? In other words, are the consulting engineers, for example, in our case, going to be paying the subs? Because when the engineers present their proposal, it often involves an estimated cost for architectural fees, hazmat. So be very aware of those. And things like hazmat, they can go through the roof if there's a discovery made and you have to shroud the building or whatever, big things like that. So,
I wish I'd been able to come to a seminar like this before we started our project. It would have helped open our eyes a lot. I think the major, I was just talking to John Grubb, and I think our major a major mistake, let's call it a mistake, it was that we thought we were into a simple construction job, and we weren't. I think we should have looked around, maybe with some experience that we might have got from coming to a seminar like this, and looked for a project manager that was more appropriate for the problem that we were finding. I think we had a project manager that was probably not appropriate. It worked out well in the end. I mean, at the end of the day, things did work out. But I think if we'd had more experience from, you know, being able to talk to people who'd done jobs like this and had picked a project manager that was more appropriate for the challenges that we had.
I'm not sure that I can say that there's anything that I wish I'd known before the project began, because I already had some experiences in the past. I will make a comment, though, that, you know, in terms of having engineers as project managers, and even designing, you've got to keep in mind, yeah, perhaps they're out for number one. Yeah, they're a commercial company. They make money. But on top of that, they may sound, and both in, if they're doing depreciation reports or project management, their estimates may be high for a reason, because they're looking at it from the point of view that engineers have specific codes to meet up with. They can't go by fly-by-night guesses. And so their tendency when it comes to a depreciation report, for example, may look high. Well, they cover themselves mostly because they say they're basing it on a particular framework, and that's plus or minus 50%. And they tend to estimate for 50% plus. So, yes, you have to take it very carefully, but bear in mind that's the outside figure. And as Jim said, it's up to you, once you've had a look at them, to say, well, okay, I don't think that's right. And that's when you have to go and seek local input. To say that a boiler is going to cost $5,000, that's an estimate, you know, maybe plus or minus. Well, it's generally plus. You may be able to go downtown, talk to a dealer, and say, well, yeah, we can put it in for $3,000. Well, okay, that's realistic. Anyone who's doing a depreciation report has about one day to have a look at your property and then look at the documentation that you produce. So give a depreciation report provider some break. And remember, that's just the start. You still got to do your homework to figure out what it is you're going to work with. But other than that, I don't have much to say about our projects, because I already knew pretty much how we were going to plan it.
Thanks, David, because that kind of segues into something that I think it was it Cleve that told us who has from Vizoa who has done workshops before. Have if any of you have taken our managing the contingency reserve or the one that follows the depreciation report, he made a suggestion at one point. He said, look at your depreciation report and identify the three highest ticket items. And then if you're questioning whether that's high enough or low enough for you to budget for, I'm not saying an actual price to do them, but to budget for, ask the trade, which is exactly what both Jim and David have really said. There's nothing wrong with going to your boiler company or your roofing company and saying, is this a reasonable amount for us to be saving for, or should we bump it up a bit or whatever? Because really, you're just trying to save enough, and a few years before the project comes up, you should be addressing it in detail. But if it's down the road and you're just wanting to make sure you're saving enough, I thought that was the best advice I ever got from Cleve. Because it's really just such a simple concept, but once you know it, it just makes so much sense. We have two hands up, one over here, then at the back, and then over here again. Sorry. You got missed, but we'll come back to you then. Okay.
At what point do you know you need a project manager? Like you mentioned they need to paint the wall and you didn't need one. Where does it become a need?
Well, even with our simple painting project, honestly, I think relying on the expertise of your council members, who among us are all of these things? Most of us aren't accountants, engineers, construction experts of any kind. I mean, I think we thought we were doing well at this simple little project, but even it illustrated that the amount of knowledge we had was very limited. So if we had known there was such a thing as a painting consultant, we just thought, the painters will be able to tell us. So to me, it is an absolutely fabulous experience for my strata to go through, because we have to paint the exterior of the building in the next couple of years. This is a dry run of a fabulous experience, because now we know that there are painting standards, that there is someone who understands. If we went to paint the building and one of the painters said, you just use this kind of latex. Well, can you imagine if it was the wrong choice of a paint and we had just spent $125,000 to paint our building? A couple years later, we find out that it's failing and we have to do it again. I mean, I think it cost us $500 or $600 for this consultant to come in and analyze the conditions and tell us what type of paint and write up the request for quotes. It was the best $500 or $600 we've sent since I've been on council in 4 years. I mean, it was so smart, but we just didn't know that he existed. So maybe we should have talked to the painters to find out. We had the woman just behind was next, and then we're going to go over to the side and then back here.
I guess this is just a comment, but I feel like when you're paying, $10,000, $15,000 for a depreciation report, and I know we're all guilty of trying to get that price down, but it seems to me that you're going to somebody who deals with the industry day in and day out, and they have projects all over the area, mm-hmm. So they should have a fairly close idea in terms of costing. So I guess I'm finding it's disappointing to hear that people are saying, gee, if you have your depreciation report, then go and get another opinion. I mean, in my opinion, that's what you are asking for is expertise.
Yeah, but let me point out something. At one of our previous seminars this year, it was pointed out that even in the roofing industry, the price of roofing materials has gone up, 12% each year for the last couple or few years. There is no way that your depreciation report provider 3 or 4 years ago could have predicted that.
No, and I agree. I'm just saying if it's something current, though, because I've heard a couple people mention that if you get an engineering cost, then go and go to your trade and stuff. And I'm saying if it's a current project or in your depreciation report, it seems to me it should be fairly close.
But think of it also, the construction trade has had a huge boom, this summer. In Victoria, it's really, really hard right now to find someone to do some projects because they're all so busy, and that drives up the prices. There's so many factors that could affect what your final price is. I don't know what some of our business specialists on the side would say to that, but I believe we have a comment coming to this effect.
Yeah, I can appreciate the frustration with depreciation reports. We have at RDH, we even have it within the office. We'll have a depreciation report created, and then we'll do a design report on that, on a specific scope of work, a recommended project. And we'll find that there's quite a bit of difference between the price. And we'll go back to the people that do the DR reports, and we'll be quite frustrated with them, and they'll be frustrated with us, because there's a misunderstanding about what a DR report does provide you in the way of pricing. And without going into a lot of detail, there's one really important thing, is that the pricing that you're getting is per asset. So let's say it says replace membranes in 5 years on your balconies. But the problem is that when you get to the project, you realize it's not just pulling off the membranes that needs to be done, but there's some rot, and your guardrails need to be replaced. And the scope of the project is going to affect the overall cost. Also, it doesn't include things like general conditions. Contractors have profit. They also have to provide access in the way of scaffold or man lifts. They have to provide a site office. They have a site manager. They have all the costs in terms of administering the project, as well as there's going to be consultant costs. None of that is covered in your DR report. Your DR report basically takes an asset and gives you a like-for-like replacement, right? So if you've got a roof and it's a certain kind of roof, it's going to say to replace that roof as it is, the material cost essentially, and with and labor is going to be that much. But all of the other part of the project can't be considered. And the costs aren't going to be the same. Let's say you do a roofing project while you're doing a window renewal, and scaffold is, and you're also, maybe that's not the best example. You're doing a window renewal and a balcony renewal at the same time. And you decide you also want to reclad your building. Well, the cost of all of those projects combined with one single source of access once is going to be lower than if you do them each separately. So you're going to have to provide access to install the windows. Next project, you have to provide access to change out the cladding. The next project, you have to provide access and all the contractors set up and all of this sort of stuff for that project. So all of those three separate projects together are going to have a greater overall cost than doing them all together. So the DR report, what it does is give you some guidance. It's identifying some order of magnitude pricing, so you know this is not a small project. And it's also saying these elements, as we've identified, look like they probably are going to need to be addressed within a certain period of time. So the thing to do at that point is to do an assessment. Actually go in and look at the assets that are on that list. Do a condition assessment. Open up the balcony. See what the condition is. Have a look behind the cladding. Is there an issue? Maybe that asset actually has a longer service life, is in better condition, then that could be determined based on, industry averages and some visual review. Or it may identify that, yes, that needs to be addressed, and then you can actually start to plan with an understanding of what your scope of work is going to be.
Which is kind of in a short way of saying, when you have a big ticket item coming up, start looking at it a few years ahead of time.
By the way, I'm with an engineering firm. I'm actually an architect. We do the architectural aspect as well. My recommendation would be is that you do a comprehensive building enclosure assessment right up front. Understand the whole of your building, and to be able to plan with the understanding of the whole of your building. What projects are best combined together? Which ones aren't necessary, and you can to have a better planning tool. The DR gives you an opportunity to understand what those assets are and what the general costs and what the timing is, but a comprehensive building enclosure assessment is going to give you a much deeper understanding of the specifics of your building and to be able to provide the engineering consultants with a much better set of tools to be able to determine what it's going to cost for projects. And yet we do tend to budget high, because there's one thing that we don't like to see, I don't think even less you, is to go in, do a special assessment, get halfway through a project and find out cripes, or get your tenders in and realize you have to go back for more money. That's always an awkward thing.
I'm going to jump to, we had two other people, I think, with their hands up. So one on the far side of the room, John. Deborah, over by the curtains. Yep, she was before, and then we're going to come back here and then back to the front.
So one thing I really wish we'd have known before we finished our project was that when you have a contractor on site and you're in a shroud and it's leaky condo, you have no, unless it's been prearranged with your strata company, you do not have security. So if you're broken into because you're missing your doors and your windows and you're not home or you're at work or you're out of your unit and you have a theft, you cannot go back to the contractor. That is up to your council and the contractor to provide security for that area, knowing that that building is left empty with no doors, no windows, and whoever on site. So I wish we'd have known that. And when I reported a theft to my council, I was told to not say anything to anybody else in case it went rampant through the unit. I think that's really unconscionable, and that I held my council accountable for not protecting me and not and leaving my building empty and knowing it was empty and then not protecting me, saying they didn't have security.
So a good project manager might bring up that point, that security is something that should be considered in the budget. Yeah. Just to let our panelists know, this is all coming from what was the one thing we wish we'd known. We're going to move into financial stuff soon, but let's just have the last two questions.
Okay. Okay, this goes to what you went through with the painting. This might be a silly question, but how do you find a painting consultant?
It was one of the painters, one of the painting companies that said, who wouldn't quote the second time because they didn't agree with the MPI paint that we decided to get quoted on. They said, we think you need help. Here's a company, that's all they do. And that's what we did.
Can you give us a name?
Maybe after.
Okay, thank you.
We don't really want to be up here saying, here's a good company, here's a bad company. As far as I know, they're the only one, so we can talk about that later.
I was just going to address that. Like, is there any list for an areas that they're in, like project managers or painter consultants?
You know, there's resources that everyone has, like Better Business Bureau. Certainly, there are. I don't know all of the associations' names, but there are associations for construction. I think there's a Builders Association too, which might be separate. And certainly, and all the engineers are part of associations. Do you have a property manager? I'm sure that they have many contacts that they've already made, so they might be a good first resource. Do you think that's? It's hard. I know it's a really huge problem for us as councils to know who is a good contractor or not. All we can do is do our best. I mean, Jim spoke to that process as well about checking references, doing due diligence. Important step. So now we are going to move into the more financial topics. One of the things at the beginning that is just so hard, did you have any challenges getting owners to approve your project? I've heard one of the panelists I was hoping would come today, it took them 3 tries of general meetings, and I think it was almost 3 years before they could even get their project approved by owners.
I think in a building of our size, about 100 units, you're going to have people that can pay for the projects and people that can't pay for the projects. And some of the people that can't pay necessarily are going to definitely have a problem with the project and find a way to either defer it or say it's not necessary. Leaky windows just need some more caulking, which is definitely not what we need in our case. We have windows from 1960s, and they have no thermal break, you know, aluminum really thin. They're just not up to snuff, and they're failing now. So we had a huge amount of difficulty in the informal meetings, the information sessions, as we call them, completely voluntary. They're not even minuted in our building because they're personal, open discussions between among the ownership. And lots of opposition to the balconies. Some from an aesthetic viewpoint because we had brick balustrades. Those brick were going to either be prohibitively expensive to rebuild afterwards. They would have to be higher up to code. And so we had to decide between brick, we wanted to include it as an option, picket railings, and glass and aluminum. We went with the glass and aluminum in the end. It's a big aesthetic difference in a building from the 1960s, but one of your questions, I think, is when all is said and done, are buildings worth more now? So we could add, owners could ask more money because we've got beautiful new balconies and railings. So, but huge opposition. Yeah, many people who can't pay it, and don't want to move, they're going to fight it tooth and nail. When it comes down to the special general meetings and the AGMs, I've found consistently, generally sort of wisdom of crowds, that reason and logic, you know, this is our asset, this is our investment, we have to invest in it. And one point that Sandy made to our council several years ago at an AGM is that you have to be aware that as you're living in your building, it's costing you something. Our building went about 25 years with some of the lowest condo fees in the world. We're now paying a 30% increase 3 years ago in our condo fees. 30%. So we're now one of the most expensive ones, say, in James Bay, but we're approaching a fully funded model. So our DR, which says all these things are coming, we can avoid, for the most part, with the exception of our window project, we can avoid special levies. Now, some people like levies, and some people don't, and I'm sure many of you know exactly the logic that's behind those two opinions. But in terms of the DR and the spirit of it, financial planning, planning for the future, no surprises, I think it's good to approach a fully funded model where you've got a healthy contingency fund so that you're not asking people at short notice, relatively short notice, for a lot of money. So
Jim, did you just have to have the one general meeting to get the balcony project approved? Or did it fail the first time?
Well, first of all, we had to approve the funding for the consulting engineers. So we got that, which in our case of a $750,000 project was about 10%. So about $75,000 we had to get approved. And then we could engage the consultants, and they would then come up with the specification and the opinion of probable cost. And then we had a number to go to the ownership with and say, we need this amount of money. It's still very rough. You know, it could be more, it could be less. We're hoping because they're engineers, they've padded it nicely so that our surprise will be lower. But just a word to that, you know, we got a window project that's about twice what the DR said it was going to be. The 2012 DR and the 2015 DR, they were 100% off in terms of the costing. So I understand that engineers may not include some of the other things, but if it's a project like the balconies, ask about hazmat. What could this cost us? Put it in the DR. What use is that document if it doesn't help us plan? If it's 100% off, it's not helping us. Does it include the remediation of your landscaping at the end, you know, because that sort of thing. And I know that it's too much to ask of lay people to consider all this stuff, but it's certainly use your imagination when you talk to the engineers or the project managers and say, what could possibly go wrong? Because what point is the DR if it's 100% off? You know, that's not helping us at all. Maybe relative costs of things, but I would say definitely ask those questions.
How about you, Tony? How did the owners,
well,
were they accepting of it the first time around?
Once we revealed the rot in the balconies, we pushed it as a safety issue. And that seemed to get people's attention. They're much more concerned about, say, it wasn't something cosmetic. This is a safety issue. If you don't fix it, your balconies are going to fall down. So That worked on people. We did have one person who couldn't afford and was pushing back, but that was one person in 11. So the majority, we had the vote to fund it. Another thing that we'd this was going back a little bit now, but when I first arrived there and we'd come up with projects we wanted to do and. We heard this comment. I don't know whether other stratas get this, but people would say, well, I'm not going to be alive for very much longer, you know. Why should I, why would we want to do this for? Anyway,
it's so that's when I, you think.
That's when I started in, I started inviting the kids along. And we, no, they, and people went along with it. Some, we had one lady that couldn't speak English very well, another one that was quite deaf, and so I said, well, look, why don't you get, you know, if you're not hearing things, you can't understand it, bring your kids along. Which they did. Well, the kids had quite a different opinion about, you know, get it done, Mom.
Yeah, I've heard, I think practically everyone's heard that one, kick the can down the road. The challenges I have, last year was reasonable, but I keep on running into this problem of trying to educate the owners again. This year we want to do phase two, which is the other building. It's the same kind of project. And because of the problems we ran into last year, and I won't go into them, our probable costs are going to be far higher than we had originally anticipated. Certainly I had, and our project manager. So they went up and people just said, oh my God, we can't do that. And where are we going to get the money? And we should really back off. And do we really need to, you know, come on, give me a break. But their ultimate thing at the town hall meeting was, well, let's get two or three more quotes. And we have had a problem going back and saying, just a minute, you can't shop out quotes on nothing. We have a pretty good idea of an overall cost. That is an opinion of probable cost. It's kind of what we should be looking at as a budget. Big, yes. But you don't try to go to contractors and say, well, could you guys come and give it? You know, you're right back to where you started. You're saying, you're going to ask each contractor to come up with the same information, but they don't know what they're bidding on. They don't know what they're looking at. And I'm trying to educate people, and so is my project manager, to say, look, that's just a maximum budget cost, and we got to have the money in place. We don't have to spend it all. And we will only know the real cost, more or less, or pretty close, is when we put a very specific project out with all the design drawings, all the engineer specifications, everything that the engineer has worked on. We spent some money, you know, getting those designs done. So we will not know until those guys, you know, those contractors, had an opportunity to look at those specifications, walk around the building, have a good look at it, go away and sharpen their pencils. And everything that is specified in the general contract terms asks for all of that. How much is it going to cost down to the last penny? And even if you go have to pay overtime for something, what's the cost of your labor? How much is your supervisor? How much is your journeyman? How much is your, you know, all of that. That's what you get your money back on. And that was, you know, that's the problem I have in getting owners to understand that.
Can I ask a question, David? Do you do it in a two-step way that, like Jim did, where you get, say, in his case, $75,000 approved to do the design phase and specifications? Or do you try to get all the money first? Because that is a different approach.
You're quite right. Originally, last year, we got the money for, because we'd already been, already it had been identified we got a problem. We got some money, $7,000, for an engineer to come in, cut holes in the wall, have a look, and give us an opinion about what was wrong. From that, we worked out the OPC. And because of all the add-ons, because he looked at you know, the condition of the building envelope and said, well, okay, we dodged the bullet, we don't need to do this, but you're going to have to re-slope the decks so that they won't cause the problem again. That's added. And by the way, in order to re-slope the decks, we have to take the guardrails off, which means it's going to cost you more equipment. So, and on and on and on. And we came up, as I said earlier, with two opinions of probable cost. One using aluminum guardrails, which is nice and modern, and the other is replacing them with a similar product of siding. And we had those two quotes, and that's what we went with. It was the engineer who designed that budget.
So just to, without getting into all the details of the project, so you did a two-step that time.
It's a two-step, and you should. You can't go because you have to look at the overall project and say, okay, there is probably what we've got to do. Once the owners have decided, okay, we're going to pay that much money for that particular overall project, and our bunch, we gave them two motions at an SGM. One was for the expensive project, one was for the cheapie. They went for the expensive one. Fine. We've got $190,000 in the bank, or we will be raising it. That's what we will spend. Then you go back to the engineer and say, fine, now we get to the specifications. That's at that point when they start drawing the specifications for the guard walls, because they know instead of the aluminum stuff, they're going to build guard walls. Instead of this, they're going to put that in. They'll work out how much money for coring, how much money for... But
David?
Yeah.
Sorry, I'm going to cut you off there because we kind of talked about the process already.
Yeah.
This question was more just, you know, were there any challenges getting approved?
There were two. The thing is,
I'm going to move on.
Yeah, well, keep in mind, at the end of this project, we had so much money left, we went to the engineer and said, could you produce the drawings for the next phase?
Oh.
Done.
Excellent. Yeah. We have a question at the front.
Yeah, I'm just wondering about in our townhouse complex, we have 60 townhouses. The majority of them are rental pool, a very small percent are the owner-occupants. So in order to have town hall meetings, and most of the owners live in Alberta, some in Vancouver, and I'm just wondering if anyone's had that issue and how we can proceed, because it's up until now we haven't had contact information for the owners. It's been kept from us, but we've just now got that. And so how to communicate, how to, so you haven't promote this.
So in the past, when you've had a general meeting where you've tried to circulate information beforehand, not the notice, but just information, Have you done that by mail or by email, or have you ever tried?
I personally believe it hasn't happened.
Okay.
And I'm not, I have a very strong belief that didn't happen. So we've just opening up a communication possible channel now. But we're just wondering how to, because we're totally into the town hall meeting thing, but there's only 12 of us there, and we know where we live, we know what it's like. So
maybe Jim could try. You do have some absentee owners as well, don't you, Jim? And you do a really good job of communicating with your ownership.
It isn't easy, but and Sandy or Wendy as well, you need a quorum, basically. You need that quorum to vote funds. Right, so you can't make any decisions without that. If a number of owners choose not to care, then they're just, you know, it's like not voting. But that's painful for us because we're self-managed. We're hoping that through engaging a property management company, they'll help with the mailings and stuff like that. But it's usually on our backs to contact those people, find out whether they're okay with email or whether we have to send them packages, you know, SGM packages, AGM packages, huge amount of work. And so that's why part and parcel of these big projects is to ask for enough money outright And it's so painful when you're looking at, say, a $200,000 job and someone says, add 25%. You know, emotionally, you don't want to do that. But prudently, it's okay. It's always better to have too much than too little. But I don't know a way around to answer your question.
Well, in terms of communication, I can say that less than 4 years ago, when I first got on council, I was quite the hated woman because I introduced email. They had never sent an email between council members, from what I understood, before that. Within about a year, we had more than 60% of the owners on an email list, and now we have, for 94 units, we have a little over 90 email addresses, but of course some of them are co-owned. But it's been fabulous. In the first 3 months even, the people who lived elsewhere were so thankful. They had not seen minutes or anything in years. They were just like, wow, this is great to know what's going on. So it's a lot of work, it takes a lot of time, and you know, we now try to do fun things, not just the serious emails, but you know, saying a bit of a newsletter with lighter topics once in a while. We don't send junk, but it does take a long time to try to figure out how to communicate with people. And don't get me wrong, I still get complaints. I still get people saying, well, what do you mean there's a meeting? I never heard about that. We just had an SGM where the people were saying they didn't get any information. We had 10 information meetings, 5 surveys, and 2 of those meetings with experts there to help us. So, you know, you can't win sometimes, but you can try. But I feel for you with absentee owners. I think there's other people in the room who probably feel that frustration as well.
So did you form like a communication committee, or did you just did that yourself?
Just at a council meeting, we decided to set up a email address that just said, you know, our name at gmail.com sort of thing. Just an official council address. We do not use it for conversations. All we do, people can send their official letters to council by email. They don't expect a reply to that letter because it's an official correspondence, needs to be discussed, but we do use it a lot for outgoing. So anytime we want to send out an agenda, or we want to send out a newsletter, or we want to say the boiler broke down, it'll be back up in 2 hours, whatever. It's a great way of communication that way, but we definitely use it as a very, it's not a personal voice, it is a council voice.
I'm just going to butt in with a couple of things. If you're using email to communicate with your owners, you need to get them to opt in. You can't just assume that you have their permission to use their email for official communication. So keep that in mind. A lot of stratas will have everybody sign a paper with their email address and saying, I agree to use this for official communications. Otherwise, you still have to mail them that package. But as for your informal town hall meetings, I know that can be really hard when you have absentee owners or owners who just can't make it out to a meeting, and you'd be surprised how inexpensive a conference call is. You know, set up a conference call with your phone provider and everybody can dial in from wherever they are. Put it on a speakerphone so everybody can hear everybody, and you'd be amazed how well attended that sort of a town hall could be. You could also do some sort of a video conference if you have a little bit of money for that. People can dial in and actually see the video conference on their computer at home in Alberta or wherever they live. So investigate those options. If you're doing a big, huge project, it's important to get everybody's opinions in advance and not just their piece of paper that comes in the mail as a proxy for the voting. So I just wanted to throw my 2 bits worth in.
I'm sorry, was there another question about communication? I thought I saw a hand up.
Can we just move on with the agenda, please?
Yep. How did you fund the project? Was it all CRF? Yeah, we'll come back to Jim and go through.
It was a combination of CRF and some levy for the balcony project that we had. And again, there was a conflict of ideology because some people said, no, we want to raise the fees even more and so that we'll have the fully funded. But in the end, we lessened the burden of the levy through a draw from the contingency. We left a lot in the contingency because we were building it up for those other projects that were mentioned in the DR. So that was it was a combination with us.
Combination. Well, this project was in 2011, and I think as I mentioned before, the community had favored levies rather than using the CRF, so the fees were low. So what in this project, it was primarily levy it was about $10,000 a unit, and then it was made up with about $30,000 from the CRF. No, we got it.
Sorry, go ahead.
Thank you.
Oh, sorry. The question was, do you get the, if the assessment is $10,000, do you get it all up front, or does it come in
bits? I got it. Yeah, up front.
I think there's some stratas. If it's a very large amount, they might step it over, what, David, about maybe two or three?
Section 108 deals with special levies, and you can set a time frame that it will be paid by such and such a date. If you're well aware that the project isn't going to start for 6 months, you can stagger it so you can give them a break and say, you know, okay, I don't care how you get the money, but pay us. You need to. Some establish deadlines saying you must pay X number of dollars every quarter. So it's a matter of what you can agree to.
Yeah, this is just a quick question on that. So did you need to get a three-quarters vote then? You got three-quarters of the membership agreed to pay $10,000 for your special levy?
Be very careful with...
I'm asking on the gentleman who got $10,000.
It was agreed to.
By three-quarters of the...
Yes.
Okay.
Yeah, the method, the amount and the method of payment was agreed to at an SGM.
Things have changed a little bit since the law changed about a year ago.
Yeah, bear in mind, you need a three-quarter vote for a special levy. You can't, if you've got a depreciation report and you're taking money out of the reserve fund, you only need a majority vote. If you're going to special levy, or if you don't have a depreciation report, you need a three-quarter vote. But bear in mind, that's a majority or three-quarter vote of those who are present in person or by proxy at a general meeting. It's not three-quarters of the entire membership.
So just out of curiosity, I mean, I do remember someone saying they had an $11 million project. There's some big projects. Did anybody go to a bank looking for a loan for their strata, or did everybody did? Let's get the microphone, because this... I don't know about the rest of Vizo, but I often get asked about this, and I think it might be interesting to hear a story.
Yeah, we got a loan for a hybrid solar hot water system, and it was essentially the loan was for how many years?
Seven
years. So we're hoping that the savings will eventually pay it off over 7 years. But I did want to ask about, because I'm not sure it got dealt with at the beginning, the actual definition of a large repair renewal project. And I'm sure that would differ from strata to strata because of the size of the strata and the size of their depreciation contingency, the resources available to them.
I'm sorry, was that a question? It was a question?
It was a question about...
Well, we're talking about large projects, but yeah, that a large project is whatever a large project is to you.
Yes.
Absolutely. And okay. I think the illustration of our tiny painting project in my building shows that you can even apply these principles to your small project.
Yeah, and remember, a $10,000 project for a fourplex is a lot larger than a $10,000 project for 50. So
the next question is about staying on... Oh, I'm sorry, there was a hand up at the back.
I wanted to say I represent a 15-unit building in Campbell River, and we had to replace most of our elevator. We went to Community Futures. They were very good to us. It was the first loan they had given out with no collateral, basically, and it worked very well for us.
That's our understanding, too, is that, remember, as a strata corporation, you don't really own anything that you have as equity. All the equity is in each individual owners. So I have heard that there are a few banks that do offer strata loans, but certainly something I'd love to hear personal experience on one day, because it's a bit...
I would too, because in the past on the helpline I've said be very careful, because the banks didn't care, and only now are we seeing that some of the credit unions are getting into it, because banks look at it and say, oh, we can't lend you the money because you cannot mortgage the property. And that's the real issue they have. There are other ways of getting around it, but so it's just starting. I'd be very interested to know how that works.
Community Futures is the federal government, and is operated under the auspices of the federal government. Our property manager in Camel River found them for us, and we were able to do our funding by giving our unit people the option of paying a certain amount outright against the loan, which reduced our interest quite considerably. And for those people who were in financial difficulty for a lump sum, we were able to do a monthly fee for them. We have paid it off in 5 years.
I'm sorry. Jim wanted to speak too.
Oh, go ahead. Mm-hmm. For me? For the loan that Bill was speaking of, the security was in the strata fee. They had and I can't remember what it was called exactly, but kind of promise of that amount of the strata fee going forward.
Right, kind of like a garnish on wages, only this would be on the strata fee. Jim?
If a project is of a certain scale and contractors will be bidding for it, what we've learned in the last two projects is contractors want to know that you have the money. So first of all, there's two steps. You have to have shown that you've had a meeting and a vote and approved those funds, and some people will want to see the money, okay, before they start. Because if it's a big project, a contractor spends a lot of time bidding on that project. And if times are good, like they seem to be in Victoria now, I don't know, it's hard to get sometimes then. So that's something to be aware of. We also are experimenting with not getting a loan, because we have a hard enough time from the one or two people that don't pay the levies, you know, going through that process, the administrative costs. We're looking at maybe a home equity line of credit approval. In other words, to show a bidding contractor that we've been approved for the money and that we can cover the cost, could then defer, maybe some of you have this experience, we can then defer the actual payment of the owners a few months, let's say. And also with that time comes a more accurate opinion of probable cost. In other words, the DR, which in our case are a couple of projects, very inaccurate. Then came the engineer's opinion of probable cost, much more expensive than we'd expected. And then final, the real cost is going to be what the most accurate one will be what the contractor bids, what he says he'll do it for. So we'd love to give our ownership as much time to save up the money as possible. And so we're exploring the route of getting an approval for a home equity line of credit, not taking out a loan, with no intention of actually drawing on that line of credit, because we don't want to go into debt, obviously. So that's one, maybe a model that maybe will work. And again, we're just researching it. Some of you may know the answer to whether that would work or not.
So. I'm going to just lump the next three questions sort of all together, because you each have a different perspective of answer. It has to do with the budget. How much of a contingency did you allow for? Did it stay on budget? Did you have to have additional general meetings to approve more funding? Maybe it came under budget. Why?
I think I've covered some of those points already. So it was more expensive than we thought. If you defer a project, it's always going to be more expensive, probably. So
you did have some contingency, which seemed to be good for the most of it.
Yeah. Let's say half the population of our building said, no, don't draw on the contingency. We're going to need it in a couple of years for the next projects.
I mean, how much contingency for the project? So if the project was going to be X amount, did you allow an extra 10% to cover unforeseen expenses or surprises?
Yeah, we didn't allow enough.
You didn't allow enough. Okay.
Let's say maybe 15%. We probably should have gone to 25%. In our project of $750,000, say.
Thanks.
No, we said, well, we did have the surprise of with the damage, the water damage that we found, and it essentially doubled the cost of the project. What were the other questions?
Well, already. Just to do with whether you're over budget or under budget.
We were definitely over budget.
And so there's no way you could have planned enough of a contingency into that project?
I think we had a contingency on the original amount of something like 10%, which was obviously nowhere near enough to cover what the final cost was.
We had a 10% contingency built into our budget. It worked out. It allowed us to cover a couple of things that we hadn't thought about, which was very nice. In fact, because of the way the project went, there were some other things that some problems that we ran into that the contractor probably ate and wasn't very happy about. And that's reflected in phase two, where they're pretty well sure where it's going, but we're still putting in another 10%. You always need a contingency. There's something that will go wrong.
But you did tell me, and you told us with the numbers earlier, you actually came in quite a bit under budget, and you were able to use that $30,000 towards the next phase, something like that. Yeah. So that's, and David had explained to me the reason why they came in under budget is using that opinion of probable cost, using those higher numbers to plan for, and knowing that it would likely come in under, right? In a nutshell. Yeah. Pretty soon we're going to open the floor to just questions. The last things were there any impacts on strata fees following this project, and any change of impression or real, and Jim's already mentioned the real estate, but the whole real estate factor, how those two things may have been affected after the project was done. And was there anyone who couldn't pay? How you handled that? Yeah.
We're still trying to collect on a project that ended a year and a half ago. So little bits, and which costs, you know, as council, so much stress, you know. But we obey by the Strata Property Act, so we can only do those things and apply those mechanisms that it allows. In terms of convincing an impact on the huge impact, positive impact on the building. However, as part of the convincing of people that didn't want to pay or couldn't pay or whatever, for whatever reasons they had, we solicited opinions, one-pagers, from real estate agents that said, this is going to have a massive impact. So we got some professional opinions to make an overwhelming argument. Although we saw partly a safety concern, you know, we had reinforced concrete balconies that were taking a beating. So it was a combination of the safety, the added value to the quality of life, and the and our investment.
We had one person that couldn't come up with the money. We took rather a hard-hearted view of people. It's your place. You better find the money. We're not going to, you know, find it for you. There was even somebody in the building who suggested we should loan them the money. No. That's your problem. You've got to find the money. You live here. If you were living in your own house, you'd have to come up with the money. And, I don't really know what happened, but I believe the gossip was that she got a chip mortgage to pay for it. We've certainly had lots of good feedback about the look of our building now. It's now looking more like maybe 1999 rather than 1972. And, we've had people actually, we sort of sit on our balcony, so people walk by and they quite often say, any places for sale in there? You know, and so, you know, people feel good. They've actually done something which is probably certainly made the place look nicer and probably increased the value of it as well.
I guess it's a bit early yet. I haven't heard any real feedback. There's one unit on that was up for sale and within this last week, and there was an offer on it within 2 days. But that was the other building. But I got a call from the realtor who was very interested in phase two and said, are you going ahead with it? And I said, yeah, we're certainly working on it. So realtors are certainly looking at it, and so are bankers, as a matter of fact. They're looking at depreciation reports, and are you doing anything with the depreciation report? Are you upgrading? Are you looking after your building? And I think that, you know, they will continue as the real estate market, and the realtors are going to start looking more and more to that. What are you doing? Are you keeping it up? Is this a good place to live? And so, of course it'll go straight up.
So we'd like to open it up to questions. I'm just going to remind you the names of our panelists so you can direct your question at which one. I'm Wendy, then we've got Jim, Tony, and David. So hopefully you have some good doozies of questions for us. Bring them on. Or share your own experiences in your own stratus as well. At the front.
I think I need to ask Jim. It was you who mentioned that it's an ideology as to whether you have special levies or contingency or a bit of both. Now, if you have special levies only, say, then if someone who's in the know with the depreciation report says, oh, there's a big cost coming up in the next few years, I'm going to sell now, get out.
I'm going to sell?
Yeah, say, and somebody thinks, I'm going to sell so I can avoid this $10,000 levy. So from that sort of point of view, I would argue that probably a contingency-funded repairs would be better.
Yeah, I mean, if you're trying to sell a place just before a big levy comes, it's a point of negotiation because it's on the record. Anyone that's a prospective buyer sees the depreciation report, they see the minutes of the meetings, they see the discussions if they're vigilant. And so let's say you got a $20,000 levy looming, that's a negotiating, and on a $400,000 condo in Victoria, that's peanuts. So that's within negotiating. That's how I view it. And so when the balcony project came, and it was going to be about a $7,500, we have unit entitlements, so they're different. So if you're higher up, you pay more. Let's say a $7,500 levy, someone posted a notice saying, by the way, this price minus $7,500 because there's a levy coming. So it becomes a point of negotiation.
Is anybody in the opposite position where you know you need the project done to keep your building looking like it's not going to be losing its property value because it's starting to fall into repair? I mean, that's the opposite to this real estate question, right? It's one thing to say, oh, we've done the project, it's looking nice. Is anybody in the other direction where you really, really, really need to do it, but you... No?
This is where your question is at.
John, we've got a question at high tech. At high tech. Sorry, go ahead, David.
Oh, this is where if someone knows and they're trying to get out, as Jim said, it's negotiable. Because if I know I'm going to buy in, but I see in the minutes that we've got this levy, I'm going to say, well, look, I'm just taking $10,000 off my offer because I'm not going to pay ahead of time. You should have been paying. And the way a special levy works, actually, is that once it's passed and they're starting to collect, the current owner pays into it until he sells, and then the seller takes over the rest of it. The distaff side of that one is, maybe the good part, if the money's coming out of the contingency reserve, now I as a buyer say, ooh, that's very nice. Knowing that when I buy, that's fine, we're probably going to see an increase in the reserve fund. Okay, that's fine. You know, I'll do my bid then. So there's an iffy thing. And realtors are certainly looking after, especially the comment about, you know, what happens if you aren't doing anything. That's why bankers, realtors are looking at the depreciation report. And if any of you read the November 2014 bulletin, I wrote an article saying, you've got your DRR, what now? And the whole point is, do you have an asset management plan in place? Because I think eventually people who are loaning money are going to say, that's fine, because the report, you can file it, but are you doing anything about it? And that's going to be the significant thing.
So at the back, John, and then we'll come up to...
Well, hi. We've just started a project. We've hired a project manager and just getting the initial reports and pulling the project together. One thing that we did was we asked very strongly if we can phase this so that we can properly budget and have it as an ongoing issue. We're starting with the worst part, and we see division lines where we can phase this and kind of go around the building and upgrade. And I just wanted to put that out there. And it just seems like a very practical way to go rather than saying, okay.
Doing it all at once.
Doing everything at once, whether it needs it or not, but we're kind of working our way around the building and taking care of a water and grass issue, starting with the worst part. So seems to look like it's going to come together. We've got a project manager on it.
It actually brings up we have a question near the front, but maybe, John, while you bring the mic up, I'll just tell this quick story. At one of our Bozoa workshops not that long ago, a woman raised her hand and said, well, our property manager said we had to replace the roof on all three buildings all at the same time because it's in the depreciation report. And I said, no. If they're different conditions, you decide what condition they're in and how many need to be replaced. You can choose to do them all at once to save money on labor and materials, but that's your choice. So that's another thing. If there is a way of phasing it that makes sense because there's longer life with something, then that's something that you and your consultants can consider. Just because it's in the depreciation report on a certain year, it does not mean that that's when you have to do it. It's up to you to decide when it's right for your building. And we do have a question.
Well, it kind of fits into my question. Like in my strata, I know the depreciation reports came out in 2013, I believe. Well, our management at that time kept advising us to defer. And to this date,
defer doing the report?
Yes.
Okay.
And to this date, we do not have a depreciation report.
Oh, I see. Okay. Yeah.
Right? And yeah. Now our AGM is going to come up this year in October, so we're going to put before the membership a recommendation to, I'm in a 49-unit townhome, and we're going to put forth a recommendation that the roofs need to be done, and just what you're saying in stages, we're going to recommend over a 3-year period. But I got some good advice from Sandy talking that we should get that voted on unanimously at the AGM to agree on the total cost for the 3 years, not just 1 year at a time, because the next year they could vote that down that they're not going to do.
Well, first of all, not unanimously.
No, you know what I mean.
Okay. No, I just have to clarify.
By a vote. Democratic vote is what I meant. At the AGM, you know, a 3-quarter vote, whatever you want to say on it. But the question was to raise the strata fees and then to do a levy as well.
Yeah, what I had said, in case anybody's confused, was if you're planning to do the project over 3 years, to put that whole 3-year project to a vote now so that people can't back out in year two or in year three.
Right.
So say we're having this project, the special levy is going to be $150,000 by unit entitlement, one-third due on this date in 2016, one-third in 2017, one-third in 2018.
Yeah.
So just in case anybody misunderstood the question. But that's one way of doing it, for sure, is to spread it out over some years. And I think Jim has a similar story.
We're doing a window project right now, and we're looking at how we can save money. And one of the things would be, say, maybe doing it in stages, doing the north side of the building, which doesn't get much weather, the windows are performing okay, to defer that. But always be aware of the costs of deferring. In other words, let's say you put it out half the project 2 years. If permits have to be drawn, if specifications have to be done for the project, the spec, the available product might change, new spec. In any event, you're going to be engaging an engineer or a project manager again to do all that. So we did the math on that with the help of our consulting engineer. And we came up, it was a no-brainer, do the whole thing at once. months. Yeah. And if you're, and again, you're appealing to people that are going to be in your building for a while. For the people that are saying, I'm not going to be around in 2 years, you sort of have to discount that argument because some of us are in it for a while.
Thank you.
But deferment definitely in our case came with a huge cost that made it.
So getting back to the depreciation report, I mean, when does it come that you have to do it?
Technically, if you don't vote to not do it, then you have to do it.
Yeah, well, we do. Each AGM, nobody wants to do it.
So every AGM, it's already a motion in your package to defer it?
Yeah.
Don't put it in the package.
I don't know what's going to happen this year.
Well, put it this way, and David touched on this. The real estate industry is beginning to pressure. An awful lot of lenders will no longer give mortgages to people unless there is a depreciation report that they can review. If they are going to turn down someone's mortgage, then eventually your building is going to be pressured by the real estate by the people in your building who are trying to sell to get this report done.
Something positive too. If you have a depreciation report, anything that is identified in that report, if you want to put in special projects and stuff, you only need a majority vote at an AGM instead of a three-quarter vote. A three-quarter vote's harder to get.
Yeah, it's very practical, except in my building where we still can't get some things approved. One lady thinks that we should wait until the balconies are droopy before we fix them. Said we're looking at an average of 5,000 right now each. Doesn't seem to understand that we could be looking at an average of 40,000 each if we decide to wait till they droop. It's lost on them. I'm not alone in this, right? Sandy and I live in the same building. If we didn't have each other, we'd go insane. We have a hand up, Vic, at the very back, John, at Vic Suite.
Getting back to cost and the depreciation report and your confidence level in them, what I suggest is that if it's a project or any item that's within 3 years, that is the time maybe to look at contractors, get costs, that sort of thing. I advise all the strata councils that I deal with is if it is a project within 3 years, can you go get some estimates so that we can build it into the depreciation report? The reason the three-year period, you're going to update it 3 years anyways. So we'll go in those kind of time frames, 3 years, 3 years, 3 years. So if you have any projects within 3 years, definitely, especially the major ones, get a proper cost. We can then build it right into the depreciation reports. Where we get our costs from, there's many sources. We use RS Means, Marshall Swift. These are costly manuals. We've got about 700 depreciation reports, so we're getting feedback on the cost. For instance, the depreciation reports that were done in 2013, my cost may be quite different in 2016 in the update, because balconies may cost a lot more. Roofs may cost a lot more. We get estimates like on a roof, $140,000 to $240,000. So there's kind of ranges depending on how hungry the contractor is. So my advice is, like I say, if it's within a project of 3 years, we'll get the bid, help out your consultant. Thanks.
So John, if you could take the mic to Lynn, and then we'll come back up, just behind you there at our seminar table. Raise your hand, Lynn.
So I guess the bottom line, and it's a line that I say to people when I teach maintenance seminars, for those who understand, no explanations required. For those who don't, no explanations possible. That's as simple as it's going to be. Is you might as well talk to a pickle because you'll get the same response. So, and somebody mentioned about doing projects in stages, and I think Jim pointed out, I'd be very cautious about that. And I think there's some, was it, I can't remember the name, it might have been called Orchard House in Victoria, on the windows. So there was actually a judgment. They wanted to do one side of the building
1 year, and in stages. And the ruling came down, no, the depreciation report said the windows are failing. Not the windows on the east side or the west side, the windows are failing. So therefore, you will replace all the windows. So be very careful about things in stages, and I think as both Sandy and Wendy alluded to, and other people on the panel, that when you do things in stages, and I think Vic certainly alluded to it as well, that the price today, I can assure you, probably even tomorrow, will change. So replacing a roof or whatever the asset may be today, 3 years from now, I will guarantee you that it'll be higher. And you're always going to have pushback. The interesting part about this whole thing of strata living is when I lived in a single family dwelling, I always put some money away, but I might have been the exception. I think most of my colleagues, when something broke, they fixed it. They didn't say, well, okay, the roof's leaking, let it leak for another 4 years. They got it fixed. But there's a funny thing about strata living. Somehow there's the belief that it's not my responsibility. And certainly John Grubb, who's done our depreciation report and in our building, we have a model for our building, and Sandy and Wendy know what it is, but it's not a building, it's our home. And you have to create that atmosphere within your community, that this is your home and it's your asset.
I want to move to Lynn's building. I've said it for years. So while you walk the mic up to John up here, I'll just mention we have read the court case of the James Bay building. I don't know if it's the same as Orchard House, where the owners voted to do two sides of the high-rise building. And then when it came time to do the other two, the owners voted it down. So people on 50% of the side of the building were dealing with mold, water and grass, all sorts of absolutely horrible conditions, because the people who already had their side done thought, oh, well, we're living comfortably, we don't want to approve that now. So there's a good horror story of why maybe it was a better idea to just do the whole thing at once.
My name gets bandied about, but one of the things I wanted to talk about or point out today is throughout this, there's been a thread here. And the thread is information. You cannot get enough information before you move forward with a large project. It is up to you as council members and owners to dig for all the information you can find and actually pay to do that. It's not wasted effort. It is not a wasted investment at all. The more information you have, the better decisions the owners get to make. And it is a collective, it is a community that has to come together and agree to it. And if council walks up and says, we have to replace this roof and it's going to cost us $200,000, well, what is that based on? What information have you provided? Have you gone to a roofing consultant? Has the roofing consultant developed a design so that you actually have something to work with? Estimates of probable cost or opinions of probable cost are not gospel, they're not cast in stone, but they are really important. And the only way you get to an opinion of probable cost is by doing your homework. You have to develop an opinion of probable cost. If you don't want to do that or don't feel qualified to do that, go find somebody who can. It's really important to make that investment. Information, you can't have enough of it.
Did I see a hand up? Oh, no, but there we are. I saw a hand up somewhere, the back.
I'm curious.
And then one more question after this one.
During your projects, did you have your contract reviewed by a contract lawyer? Anybody can answer the question.
Go for it, Jim. Sorry.
Yes. Of course.
And recommended?
We made several changes. Yep, on the advice of our counsel, strata property lawyer, so, yeah.
Yeah, when I got into our strata, I went looking back for some contracts. There were none for a lot of the work done. It's absolutely scary. One more question? Anyone? Are we... It applies to townhouses, bare land,
exactly.
Apartment complex, yeah. And
It applies to your own home if you have. You could apply all of these principles to your own single-family home, too. Yeah. Well, thank you, everyone, for coming. Thank you, Sandy, for letting me come up here. Thank you.